Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
In Matthew chapter 28, verses 16 to 20, it is written, "Then the 11 disciples went to Galilee, to the mountain where Jesus had told them to go. When they saw him, they worshipped him, but some doubted. Then Jesus came to them and said, 'All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything I have commanded you. And surely I am with you always, to the very end of the age.'" That passage, which I read from the New International Version of the Holy Bible, is also referred to by many Protestants as the Great Commission, an instruction to proselytize Christianity far and wide. The early apostles certainly did this, often at great risk to life and liberty. And beginning in the mid to late 19th century, with transportation costs to faraway places becoming much cheaper thanks to improved seafaring technology, European Protestants began to missionize the globe with renewed intensity. The various European colonies and imperial outposts in Asia and Africa were the first targets, followed by parts of Catholic Latin America in the mid-20th century. Because these missionary efforts often piggybacked on European political conquest, they have often been viewed in a negative light. Missionaries were seen as heavy-handed tools of European overlords, often trying to rewrite native cultures in the image of the white man. The derogatory term "rice bowl Christianity," wherein a missionary is believed to trade necessary food to a starving population in exchange for their conversion, has often been applied to even the most well-intentioned of Protestant proselytizers. But might missionary work have a positive impact as well? After all, Protestant missions would often build schools, introduce modern farming techniques, increase access to potable water, and provide basic health care for the people who they sought to convert. For countries that were desperately poor, these things could certainly be considered a net benefit, at least in the material sense. But did missionizing also have a beneficial political effect, promoting the social conditions necessary for democracy to take root in many of these nations? Nations which had previously been governed by despotic rulers who paid little attention to their own citizenry. To answer that question, I am pleased to turn to Professor Robert Woodbury, an associate professor of political science at the National University in Singapore. He recently published a paper in the American Political Science Review, the flagship journal of the political science profession, entitled "The Missionary Roots of Liberal Democracy," which has caught the attention of scholars not only in political science, but within sociology, history, geography, and economics. His thesis is reinvigorating the debate about the causes of democracy and will likely be a much-cited article for years, if not decades, to come. But we, here at Research on Religion, have it first for you in audio form. Bob, welcome to Research on Religion.
Hi.
Hey, before digging into your fascinating thesis about missionaries, I want to situate your argument in the larger debate surrounding the rise of liberal democracy in the modern era. Some of our listeners are very familiar with religious topics, but might not be all that familiar with political science topics. Mm-hmm. So what have been the dominant explanations for why some countries have become democracies while others have remained autocratic?
Well, there's a number of different theories. Some of them deal with sort of secularization and the Enlightenment and Greek thought. So the earliest democracies, which are direct democracies, were in Greece. They're very unstable, and basically slave owners, large, very wealthy people, got together directly and discussed things. So people have talked about the influence of Greece or the Enlightenment or secularization, sort of the limitations of religion,
mm-hmm.
And then that increasing freedom. Other people have talked about economic causes of it. So either as countries get more economically developed, then they become more democratic, or with particular class structures. So different scholars have focused on different types of class structures. Some have focused on the rise of the middle class, a large middle class, pressuring for democratization, and some have focused on the working class. But these arguments tended to be based on sort of economic incentives, where you have a small elite that controls a lot of resources, and then you get pressure from these other groups to disperse resources and disperse power.
Yeah, so as other people are becoming richer and wealthier, they're asking for a seat at the political table. The middle class bourgeoisie in, say, places like England or the Netherlands, or perhaps the working class and some of the later European developers.
Right.
Okay.
Although historically, part of it depends on how you define democracy. This can be going a little bit afield, but the working class mostly pressured for expansion of universal male suffrage, as opposed to the origins of democracy in general. And they're quite inconsistent in terms of their actual support for democracy.
Let's make
that argument.
Yeah, let's go ahead and stop there for a minute and define what we're talking about in terms of democracy. I think if I mention democracy to a person on the street, the first thing they would think of is voting.
Right.
Oh, we go to the ballot box. And as you said, the working class, were promoting or at least advocating for extended male suffrage. Is that your definition of democracy? What is the accepted definition of democracy?
Well, different people use different definitions. I use a pretty expansive one. I talk about liberal democracy.
Mm-hmm.
So it's more than just elections. It's the freeness and fairness of those elections, the ability of different political parties to organize without repercussions to themselves, to propagate their ideology or their message freely. So it has some things to do with the freedom of the press, the freedom of organization, the freedom of speech. Things related to the rule of law. Does law actually shape how the government acts? So in the research I use, it's a broad definition, liberal democracy, as opposed to a narrow definition of just elections. Which even sort of dictators often have had elections. They're just not fair elections.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of how we measure this, it's sort of like a scale that goes from 0 to 100. So it's not like you're a democracy or not. It's like you're more democratic or less democratic. And
right.
No society is perfectly democratic. In every society, there's wealthy, powerful people have more influence. Money shapes elections a lot. There's corruption. There's various non-democratic things. But you have a continuum where some countries, transfer of government is freer and fairer. The interests of the people are translated into who's elected more effectively, more efficiently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those issues that you say of rule of law and civil liberties are very important. Rule of law being that once you write down a set of rules, the people who are in charge of monitoring and enforcing those rules have to adhere to those rules. And oftentimes we know that's not the case. When you get in power, people bend the rules, break the rules according to their interests. And
yes.
So,
and also, everywhere.
Yeah, and also that issue of civil liberties, I think this is going to become important in your definition of democracy as well. It's just
right.
The ability of regular everyday citizens, the people who are ruled, to go about organizing, expressing their voice, feeling secure in their property and their life becomes a very important issue too, free from arbitrary rule. Okay, so we talked about economic reasons. So the dispersion of wealth, the middle class or working class starts advocating for more say and power. Are there other theories of why some places become democracy and some don't?
Yes. Some of them focus on sort of the land tenure system, how much land the wealthy people own. Things like land, you can't transport out of a country.
Yeah.
Whereas things like cash or knowledge, you can. So they're considered liquid assets. The more wealth is based on liquid assets, things that can leave the country, that changes how elites work. And if they have, if wealth is based primarily on land, they're much more likely to use violence to protect it because they can't remove it.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of people argue that if you have more liquid assets, like education, cash, various things like that, then you're more likely to get a democracy. There's also some people who argue about education and democracy, or being an island. So if you're an island, you don't need as big a military to defend from your neighbors, for example, and so then you're more likely to democracy. And there's also some people who make arguments about colonization and democracy. So former British colonies and former Protestant colonies, with the exception of the Dutch, are on average more democratic than places that were not colonized, or places that were colonized by other powers.
And that's a really interesting observation, because we usually associate colonialism with autocracy. But when you take a look at it in the broader perspective, is some colonies did a little bit better than other colonies. And there does seem to be a pretty close association of who colonized and what the outcome tended to be. And that's something we're going to be discussing here in a second. You also mentioned the issue of secularization theory early on, too, and I just want to revisit that, because I guess the idea sitting there, then secularization theory, we've discussed this on podcast before, was that as time goes on, as we learn more about the physical world, we lose our superstitious values, and as society becomes more complex, you have different functions being taken over by different aspects of society, specifically the government, so the church doesn't do as many of the functions as it did in the past. And the association with this between secularization and democracy, if I'm correct, is that as the secularization process wears on, that old heavy-handed, heavy-fisted church that controlled everything, their power would wear thin and eventually give rise to more empowerment of people and citizens.
Right.
Okay. And one of the other things, so I want to ask you about this as we go into democracy, too, has been discussed that there's been waves of democracy. I think this was something that the former political scientist Samuel Huntington had mentioned.
Right.
Tell us, because democracy just didn't happen one day in the world. It happened at various times, and it's tended to be patterned. Give us a little indication of the waves of democracy.
Well, you had early rise of democracy in North America and in Northwest Europe, particularly Protestant areas, but also Belgium, and then a very unstable transition in France, as well as Latin American countries and Catholic countries in general. And you get then a gradual spread early on, but after World War One, you get a bunch of new countries that come into being, and they have sort of unstable democratic transition.
Yeah. So we're talking your Germanys and Japans here.
No, this is World War One, not World War Two. We're talking like, you know, Czechoslovakia and places like that.
Okay, but you had the Weimar Republic between the wars, though.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, like, but the Weimar Republic, it's like it's unstable democracy.
I see. Okay.
So you eventually elect Hitler, who then removes more and more democratic rights.
Yeah.
But does it originally democratically. And so they're not stable democracies. They don't stably protect rights of people. Then you get another wave that happens starting in the 1970s, where you get a lot of Catholic societies that start democratizing around the world, often with support of the Catholic Church. And it starts with Portugal, where there's a military revolution, and then a democratization movement, and in Spain and lots of other Catholic countries. And then there's an accentuation of that after the fall of the Soviet Union and communism in Eastern Europe, where you get a wave of democratization movements that go through particularly Protestant and Catholic areas of the Soviet Union and in Eastern Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And although this is not usually emphasized, both Protestant and Catholic churches were very crucial in that, in those movements. So the Catholic Church in Poland was crucial, and Eastern Germany, the Lutheran Church, etc., were important in places where protests were mobilized and organized, etc. And so you have this new wave, but then it also encompasses countries like the Philippines, etc., where the Catholic Church was crucial in the overthrow of Marcos.
Mm-hmm.
Now you may be having a similar wave in the Middle East. When you had the wave in Eastern Europe, you also had a wave in Africa and stuff, et cetera. But a lot of those democracies were not particularly stable, but some of them were.
Mm-hmm.
And in Latin America. And so you get these you get these sort of waves where you get movements for democracy.
Yeah, I want to come back to the issue of the Arab Spring near the end of our podcast because I want your thoughts on that. And it's one of those issues that might not necessarily fit in an easy category in terms of your thesis. But right. Nonetheless, you do provide some really interesting observations. And I think your causal logic here is spot on. One question that we didn't look at, or one aspect we didn't look at, was the issue of religion when we talked about earlier theories right. of democracy. We talked about secularization, which is kind of the flip side of religion. Mm-hmm. But we didn't talk about religion specifically. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on why a lot of scholars just seem to neglect the religious factor in examining democratization.
Well, there's more than one reason. One of it is that most academics in the social sciences are not particularly religious, and so religion is not important to them, and so then they don't tend to think religion is important to society. So they tend to look at secular explanations. They feel more comfortable with them. They know them more. You've also had a lot of influence in academia of sort of Marxist ideas, even if the people are not themselves Marxist. So they tend to think that things like class structure or land tenure or various things like that are hard. They're structure.
Mm-hmm.
And things like religion is culture. It's malleable. It changes. And it is really caused by these underlying economic and political forces, which there's some of that. I just would argue it goes both ways. And then also, I think there's a sort of uncomfortable with it because it can sound like, oh, this religion is better than that religion.
Mm-hmm.
Which is not the point in terms of a general thing. We can't say which religion is better than another religion based on its consequences for one particular outcome. There continues to be a negative association between Islam and democracy, which makes some people uncomfortable because it sounds like you're insulting Islam.
Right.
And that may or may not be causal. Well, people argue about that, but it certainly has been a consistent relationship, although you've gotten some recent change.
Mm-hmm.
There also seems to be a relationship between Protestantism and democracy, and then more recently with between Catholicism and democracy.
Yeah, it's really interesting because, as we noted, the birth of modern liberal democracy occurs in North America, the United States, and in Britain. Some people might even trace it back to the Glorious Revolution of 1688 as a critical moment, or even further back. We can debate
right.
the timeline of it. But it all seems to be happening first in Protestant Northwest Europe.
Yes.
And that seems to be this relationship. And the Catholic nations are come a little bit later in this whole process. And so one would wonder, hey, you know, don't you think that there is a correlation here? It seems
right.
to be a correlation. The correlation is not causation, but hey, maybe we should look into some of this stuff. I mean, you know, Weber, in essence, did this when he talked about his Protestant ethic thesis and the rise of capitalism. As you know, did he have anything to say about democracy?
He didn't. His goal was not to. He wasn't focusing on democracy. He was focusing on capitalism
yeah.
and economic institution. He was having an argument with Marx, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So his focus was not democracy.
Yeah, although one could, I mean, again, if you translate the economic models as well, you know, wealth grows in capitalist societies and then wealth promotes democracy and can make
right.
those causal linkages. But you're right. You know, the idea of democracy and religion was not directly linked here at all. I want to actually get into your thesis now.
Mm-hmm.
And really get down to specifying what a social scientist like to call the causal mechanisms.
Right.
In other words, the nuts and bolts of how things are actually done. Because typically, theories of religion and how they relate to things often happen on these macro historical or metaphysical terms where these, you know, large ideational movements change everything. But things happen in real life on a day-to-day and step-by-step process. So I do want to ask you about that. But before doing that, I want to ask you, and this always fascinates me how people end up with the topics that they study in their research agendas. How did you stumble upon your thesis? I mean, given the predominance of secularization theory in our field and the general neglect of the religious factor in social life among our peers, and that's been changing in the past few years, but you're doing your work well before that change starts to wash over our field.
Right.
How did you ever get to the point of connecting missionaries and democracy?
complicated story, but basically my grandparents and great-grandparents were missionaries in China. So I had this sense about missionaries, and I studied to be a diplomat, so I studied a lot of economics and political science. I mean, and then I went to seminary, and I was interested in becoming a minister, but I could go there for free because my dad taught there.
That makes all the difference in the world. You got
to
love
so
that.
So while I figured out what type of professor I was supposed to be, I studied lots of church history and missions history. And so mm-hmm. I had all this background before I went into sociology. Mm-hmm. And I was studying all this stuff in the United States, and I thought it was dumb because I've lived overseas so much of my life. And someone, a professor, Kim Boland, said, oh, there's this association between Protestants and democracy, and between being a British colony and democracy. And I started publishing this stuff in the 1970s, and everyone just sort of ignores it, and they focus on economic development and democracy, or education and democracy, those kinds of things. And he said, maybe someone should work on that. I thought, oh, that would be great. That's what I can do, because it's international, it's historical, it's something that I would be interested in doing. And so I started to think historically about if a religion shaped something like democracy, it would be a very long process. And what would be the mechanism? And so I started to think through the historical mechanism. And then I started looking for data, and I thought, maybe missionaries collected data. And then I found just a treasure trove. They were insane in how much data they collected.
Yeah, missionaries are great at doing that because, I mean, in addition to proselytizing, they have to sit around at night and they don't have plasma TVs to watch, you know, the latest shows. So, you know, you write diaries and it's not just diaries. They take – I've gotten boxes of this in my office too. They, you know, tell you how many, you know, stores of bandages and all that kind of stuff they have.
Yeah, so then they tried to collect all this data together in order to do strategic planning and to work out something called comity agreements, where they didn't want to reproduce the church divisions from the West in the non-West, and so they tried to say, okay, you go here and we'll go there and whatever. So things never worked, but they tried to map out where everyone was so that they could send people where nobody was and where they could, and so they could let okay, the Presbyterians go here and the Methodists go here and things like that.
Yeah.
So what they produce then is all the statistical data on all the things they're doing and all these maps and where they were, which allows me to link it up. So once I found this data, I'm like, oh my goodness, this is a treasure trove, and started to look into the history quite carefully. And I had some background in order to sort of have an idea about it.
Yeah.
And then seeing all these patterns and going like, oh my goodness, this is amazing. And everyone just totally ignores this. And so getting more and more excited, but doing these broad arguments that I make around the world takes a lot of time.
Yeah.
And doing the type of data work that I did, it takes an amazing amount of time.
No, one of the most impressive things I find of your research profile is that you did this immense data collection. And oftentimes that's not the sexiest thing in social sciences. It's oftentimes the grunt work, whereas, you know, publishing a glossy book is oftentimes cool. But I mean, the amount of stuff that you collected, and, you know, I know people were talking, as, oh, Woodbury's got all this data. Just, he's putting it all together. Like, wow. And I sit there and say, hey, I'm glad he's doing it, because that's a lot of hard work.
Oh, it's an amazing amount of very tedious technical work.
Yeah. Hey, let me ask you this, though. You know, as you mentioned, your Professor Boland had worked on some of this in the 70s, and nobody paid attention to him. So he just kind of jettisons, okay, you know, Protestantism is connected with democracy. Nobody's paying attention to it. He hands passes the torch to you and says, hey, look at this, you know, more carefully, you do that. Did you meet with any skepticism early on, especially since researchers are, oh, that religion thing. I remember two people would say, you know, that religion thing is really cute, but when are you going to do real social science, you know? So
yeah, I mean, well, I had professors in my department tell me, you're really smart, why are you looking at religion as a waste of your life? I had more than one professor tell me that in my department. Other people get mad, so in some of my early presentations, like I had someone stand at the audience in the middle of my talk and start yelling at me and saying, are you saying that you can go to any culture you want and just destroy whatever you want about their culture and replace it with whatever you want? And I was like, no, I'm not. I'm trying to look at historical patterns of what happened.
Yeah.
When I gave a talk at Yale, at the end of my talk, Emmanuel Wallerstein stood up and yelled at me and basically
really?
Said, that is a bunch of crap. And I said, how so? And he said, well, your whole thesis started with the idea that former British colonies are more democratic, and I don't believe that's true, so your whole thesis is based on crap. And I was like, well, I can show you about a dozen empirical articles that all suggest that former British colonies are, on average, more democratic, so it's not controversial in literature. And he said, well, it's controversial with me, and walked out of the room and slammed the door.
I have to stop here and let our listeners know about Emanuel Wallerstein. I mean, it is a big deal to be yelled at by Emanuel Wallerstein, because he's a big dude in the world of political science and sociology, and I guess history, too. He's written a compendium of books about the world capitalist system, which are very macro-historical. They're very broad-based sweeps of history, and they don't get down to the nuts and bolts of things that happen on a day-to-day basis. And so to be yelled at him is kind of a cool thing. And I've had the same experience too, right? It definitely is not cool at the time. You're a younger scholar, and all of a sudden this, you know, really important dude with gray hair is yelling at you, and you're like, what is going on? And I've had that happen to me too. And I have to admit that, it's not pleasant at the time, but it does form your character. And then later on, you can say, hey, I got an APSR article and people are talking about it. So there, Emanuel Wallerstein. And I have to tell you, and this is a little bit of a side note, there was recently a talk at the University of Washington by Emanuel Wallerstein where he starts, his argument is about maybe we should look at the issue of religion in world history.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
That was, I don't know, 2 or 3 months ago in the spring or late winter of 2012. And so I think you won that debate.
Wow.
Yeah. Probably didn't help you at the time there at Yale, but you won. So, all right. Hey, let's get into the nuts and bolts of your thesis now. And so why, in a nutshell, did Protestant missionaries, or as you call them, conversionary Protestants,
right,
become a factor in influencing the rise and spread of stable democracy around the globe?
Well, I look at it both in – the reason I use conversionary Protestants is because I start in Europe and then I also look internationally. And I argue that because Protestants wanted people to read the Bible in their own language, that they did a number of different things. One, they wanted everyone to be able to read, including poor people and women. So they're the ones who push mass education. And they do it in Europe, the earliest places with close to universal literacy, particularly for men, but also for women, are areas that were not wealthy, but were areas that had strong Protestant movements. So Scandinavia, Puritan areas of England and Scotland, New England, Iceland, Faroe Islands, places like that. And they also, and prior to this date, education was mostly done through tutors, so wealthy families would hire tutors to train their children using adult texts, often in a classical language, mm-hmm, like Latin or classical Chinese, or if you're in Japan and Korea, in Chinese. So it wasn't vernacular. But in order to do math education, you had to have vernacular education that used books that was designed for children and have graded classes according to levels, etc., where they develop all these techniques. Then also they needed to have mass availability of text, so they transformed printing from an elite technology into a mass technology, and they print in languages that is accessible to ordinary people, which forces the people who compete with them also to do education and also to do mass printing. And out of that context, you get the rise of newspapers and various things like that. They also become important in terms of creating religious liberty. So the problem, one issue with Protestantism is where it's based on God's word and your conscience, you keep on getting splits, divisions, and even though Protestants initially tried to make state churches in order to have national unity, in order to fight the Catholic Church and resist them, and so they're very scared about having too many divisions, you just kept on getting them. And these non-state Protestant groups fought for religious liberty. Some of them were Orthodox, some of them were not. So like Roger Williams, when he founds Rhode Island, etc., he's a very devout Puritan.
Right. More puritanical than the Puritans themselves.
Exactly.
Right, yeah.
But because he believes that only true faith saves people, he says that if faith is compelled, it doesn't help anyone, it doesn't save anyone, it stinks in God's nostrils.
Yeah.
Therefore, we cannot impose it. We can argue for it, we can live it, we can preach it, but we cannot have a state church, we can't impose it, we can't, because that does no good to anyone, spiritually. So you get arguments like that for religious liberty and for independence of organizations like religious groups from state control, which then creates space for other organizations to be independent from state control. And these religious organizations develop ways to spread their faith, ways to spread their message, ways to organize without state support. They instill volunteerism and charity in their congregants because they can't get state money. And so you have initially Quakers and then Methodists and other nonconformists who develop a lot of these techniques for religious reasons, and then they use them for political reasons.
Mm-hmm. So actually, I'll stop you there. I slightly disagree with that term, that they use them for political reasons. They do sometimes, like the Quakers get into the abolition movement and things right. like that. But it when you say use them for political purposes, it sounds a little bit nefarious. I think really what's going on, this is where I really like your thesis, and I've done some work on this as well, is that when people have to do things in their church, have to organize and, mm-hmm. and promote volunteerism and, mm-hmm. and get people to contribute to the church and, mm-hmm. and learn to set up church committees and all that kind of stuff, they develop these civic skills
exactly.
that then transfer
yeah.
to other areas of their life. So it's not the church sending them out saying, now let's be political.
Right.
It's like, hey, I got this set of skills. I see another problem in society, and I know how to organize stuff.
Yes, that is my meaning.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I don't want anybody sounding like these, you know, again, I get that nefarious sounding stuff too, so.
Okay, but that's what ends up happening. And you also, well, it also creates these cross-class linkages, where in England and North America, you have these political elites who want to have abolitionism.
Mm-hmm.
They want to pressure the British to allow missionaries, for example. And they want to reform society, what they perceive as wrong or harmful in society. But they don't have the power to do it themselves. And so they link with evangelical and nonconformist meaning not state, evangelical meaning conversionary, Protestants who are not in the elite to mobilize pressure for these changes that they want. But a lot of these elites are afraid of instability, and they want these protests to be nonviolent. And so they're using a lot of these nonviolent techniques to pressure the government to allow missionaries to fight slavery, etc. And those techniques are really successful because they're the first people to organize, and they're the first people to have these techniques.
Yeah, and as I point out to a lot of my colleagues who still wonder why I study religion, I got people who studied new social movements. Mm-hmm. And I want to remind them, if you're studying new social movements, you should actually study those old social movements called churches, because they've been organized for thousands of years.
Well, and what new means is new to you.
Yeah, exactly right. And, I had a colleague include me in a book on social movements. And I remember we're at a small conference here at the University of Washington on this, and everybody's talking new social movements. I come in and say, no, you know, this stuff isn't really new. Churches have been doing this for a very long time,
yeah.
which is why religion remains relevant, at least in a social terms. I'm not talking theologically now, but in social terms, churches are very good at organizing collective action, which is
yeah.
usually the backbone of all social change. You need people to come together and to cooperate, and churches have to do that, especially, as you say, these nonconformist churches that can't rely on state coercion mm-hmm. to collect their funding, to collect taxes for them, and to fund the church. They have to do this on their own, and all of a sudden they learn how to ask people for money or to, whatever they're doing, make themselves very relevant and engage the congregational base, because
right.
you know, one person can't do it all, and can't, you know, you can't pay everybody to do that. So how do you get, if you got a congregation of 200 people, how do you get 150 of these people doing something to bring everything together? And that mm-hmm. those are incredible skills. I have to say, in my own research, I know this has been shown, I think, by Christian Smith and a few others, that if you ask people questions about religion and, you know, how often do you go to church, and then ask them other questions, do you volunteer in the community? People who are regular churchgoers on average tend to also belong to an additional civic organization, be it, you know, Boy mm-hmm. Scouts or, you know, the Rotary Club or something like
right.
that, more so than people who don't go to church.
Yeah, regular church attenders are more likely to volunteer both for religious and for non-religious causes. But that's particularly true among Christians and particularly Protestants.
Yeah.
So when you look around the world in terms of the formation of voluntary organizations, social reform organization, etc., disproportionately Christian and disproportionately Protestant. Even in places like Japan and Korea and Taiwan and Thailand and Nigeria, etc., where it's not a predominantly, well, some of them are, Nigeria is predominantly Protestant, or predominantly Christian.
Yeah.
Others of those are not.
Yeah. No, and it is an interesting experiment, too. And I like the fact that you do your examination of all this on a global basis, because you could say, well, you know, it's just the Korean culture. That's how it is. Well, here's a new form of culture inserting itself into, you know, traditional Korean culture, and you get to actually do pretty much a natural experiment.
Yeah.
Or close to bit.
Well,
yeah.
That's sort of what I try and do. So I make all these arguments in Europe first, because that's where a lot of these things develop, and to show that there's the plausibility of being causal and not just a means of transmitting this around the world. And then I show through missions, it's like a natural experiment. Because in Europe, people say, oh, it's not Protestantism. It's something about the relationship between the crown and the aristocracy, or something, something, something. You know, so it's not Protestantism. It's something else that caused both the spread of Protestantism and these later democratization movements or mass education or whatever.
Yeah, it's just a spurious correlation.
It's a spurious correlation.
Why we can ignore religion. Yeah.
And the problem is, when in Europe, there's so, when you do historical analysis, there's so many different stories you can tell, it's hard to adjudicate between them.
Mm-hmm.
So what I say is, well, you have a consistent pattern in lots of places. Protestants have stable democracy earlier in Europe, in the European settler colonies, and then with Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union, both Protestant and Catholic countries democratized more stably and earlier than Orthodox and Muslim ones. So that's already making a plausible case. And then I say, well, in Europe, people say it's not Protestantism, it's this. But that thing, like the relationship between the aristocracy and the crown, or the land tenure system, or whatever, didn't shape where Protestant missionaries went. And things like climate and being an island, etc., shaped both where Protestant and Catholic missionaries went. So a lot of this, some of those things get wiped out. But, and so then you look around the world and you look historically and you go, oh, look, where you get Protestant missionaries, they immediately start doing mass education. They immediately start doing vernacular printing. They immediately start creating newspapers. They immediately start creating voluntary organizations. And look, oh, when they do that, other religious groups start to do it too, but not before.
Yeah.
So Catholic missions started way before Protestant missions, a couple hundred years. And they did limited education and limited printing and things like that, but it didn't cause other people to copy them because it was very small numbers and it didn't overwhelm the elite. So when Protestant missionaries come, boom, everyone starts to copy.
Yeah, there's a couple things going on here. I want to come back to the Catholic issue in a second, but what you do in your work, being that it is a grand sweep of history, yet it is really micro foundationally rooted, meaning that we're looking at the nuts and bolts of daily things. It really helps us to understand the spread or dispersion of democracy, because a lot of people notice this, right? There are these waves. They tend to come in patterns. But what I could be a little bit critical of the democratization literature is that people tend to isolate these waves. They say, okay, here's the, you know, post-World War I wave, and then here's the post-World War II wave, or this is the Latin America wave. Let's just look at those compartmentalized. Your broad scope of this actually traces it back to its roots in Europe, which is also why I like that you do that first wave, the old school liberal democracies. And you show, this is the stuff that's going on in the towns and in the cities. There's these little Bible study groups and they're teaching people how to read. And then all of a sudden, you know, after World War I, they're all of a sudden these Protestants are going out and they're doing the same thing that they did the last century, which is really kind of cool.
The other issue that it does is lots of people focus on sort of the intermediate mechanism. So they say, oh, you have a large middle class, or you have mass education, or you have a thriving media, you know, free press.
Yes.
Or you have lots of voluntary organizations, etc. But they don't say where those things come from.
Yeah, you got to step back one more step.
They didn't fall out of the sky.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that some countries have more education or more newspapers or more voluntary organizations is caused by something, and I'm explaining that.
Yeah.
And so the causes that they consider structural are themselves caused, and I'm arguing that they're caused by, to a great extent, by religion. And then through competition, it spreads to others. And so then people will say, oh, well, like now you have these movements in Catholic societies, or you have these movements in Muslim societies, or you have these movements in other things. But over time, these things diffuse, and they get detached from religion. So now everyone, not everyone, but most people think, oh, yeah, it's good for women to read, and it's good for poor people to read. But that historically is something that's very new. And lots of people think, oh, it's good that people have free media and access to printed material, or have organizations that are independent from state control that they can volunteer to do things that they think are important. But historically, those things, lots of people did not think that.
Yeah.
Or didn't know how to do that, or didn't put the resources to do that. Now they do.
Let me ask you a little bit about the Catholic question, coming back to it, because Catholics have had missionaries and they've spread,
sure,
but
sure.
They, when I talked about colonialism before, you go to Latin America in 1492 with Columbus, and then in the 16th century, they spread all throughout the continent, the South American and Middle American continents. And they don't give rise to democracy. No. So why not Catholics instead of Protestants? Why?
Well, there's multiple reasons. There were state church Protestant missionaries as well, but Catholic missions tends to be more closely aligned with the state than Protestant missions, at least Anglo-Protestant missions, because the Pope, through pressure, but he divided the world between Spain and Portugal into the Papadonado or the Padroado, where the crown of Spain and Portugal had the duty to spread the Catholic faith around the world, and they got the right then to appoint or approve the bishops and paid the salaries of the clergy. And so then that gave them a great deal of control over the Catholic clergy in their areas. Now, they didn't actually spend that much money on missions and didn't end up controlling the whole world. So the Pope set up this other system where he couldn't appoint bishops, so he made vicars apostolic, etc., to try and get around that. But there tends to be these closer relationship between the Catholic Church and the state, which gave the state more control over missionaries in their territory. Also, for Catholics, reading the Bible in the vernacular was not crucial. Therefore, mass printing was not crucial. When printing was done, it wasn't necessarily in a vernacular language that was close to the spoken language. Mass education was not crucial. Volunteer organizations were not crucial.
Mm-hmm.
Also, although Catholics were concerned about abuses of indigenous people, and in the 15th century and 16th century, for example, had movements led by Jesuits and Dominicans and Franciscans against abuses that were done, those were done in terms of appealing to allies in the aristocracy or the royal family,
right,
to try and put those things down. But when that person died or got interested in other things, those things were not enforced and moved on. Plus, the state had a greater ability to punish those missionaries and stop them. Then also because this close relationship between the church and state, when you get Enlightenment elites trying to take over the state, they are very anti-clerical, generally. And so it creates this life and death competition between church and state in Catholic areas that doesn't happen in certainly in Protestant areas where there's a significant non-state church Protestant groups. And so then the Catholic Church aligns themselves with very conservative forces and tries to prove that it's valuable for colonization, and really doesn't critique abuses that happen, even when Protestant missionaries do in the same area. And so during the late 18th and the 19th and the early 20th century, Catholic missionaries don't tend to critique colonial abuses, except for in like British colonies, where there's greater religious liberty. And then now recently, you've gotten a change. Now, that starts in the 1920s and 30s, but particularly after World War II, and then particularly after Vatican II. And then you start getting these, breaking the concordats, breaking these church-state agreements, and the Catholic Church becomes much more critical. And nowadays, they're probably more critical, on average, of abuses that happen. They have a lot of power to do it. But during the 19th century and early 20th century, they were not. Protestant missionaries were.
Yeah, and as you mentioned before, that you know, when Protestants come in, they create this competitive pressure in order to get either their secular counterparts to start teaching people to read lest they get left behind, and to start printing newspapers and pamphlets lest they get left behind, and to start organizing civic groups lest they be left behind. The same thing happens, too, in Latin America. When the Protestants come in, it really kicks the Catholic Church in the butt, saying, hey, we're organizing among the poor here. Mm-hmm. We're providing them a lot of things that, you know, you guys haven't been. And the Catholics look at this and say, oh, we better start doing that too.
Right.
In fact, that was a book somebody wrote about that a long time ago. So
yeah,
that was me, by the way. Yeah, I have to get a plug in for my own book here because I never get the chance to interview myself.
I noticed the plug before.
Okay. Yeah, no. So we'll link to that, by the way. The book is called Rendering Unto Caesar. So, I never get a chance to interview myself. So people just think I'm a handsome voice on the radio and not much more to it. But I actually do research. But anyway, yeah, so this is why I also connect to your research, is that you're filling in a lot of the things that I had suspected. And then, you know, you do the data work on this. And I'm like, oh, man, that is absolutely cool. Hey, well, one thing I do want to – oh, I should mention, sticking with the Catholic theme too, when it comes to this third wave or the, I guess, the post-communist wave of democracy,
right.
Again, the Catholic Church is – pretty influential there too. We're in post-Vatican II areas, but you know, your thesis that you need religious organizations to be organizers, to create civic space in order for people to protest and to claim their individual rights and to advocate for rule of law. This is what happens in places like Poland and Lithuania.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, that's, you know, so it's, you know, it's not necessarily a Catholic theological thing, but, you know, in Poland, the Catholic Church was the outsider under the communist regime. In Lithuania, after, you know, the Soviet Union basically took it over in a deal with Germany during World War II, Catholics say, hey, no, we don't want this, so we're going to organize counter pressure. And they provided that space for people to right. argue.
And also in the Philippines, Cardinal Sin organizing against Marcos, etc. So once you get this greater separation between the church and state, and you have this rapprochement between the Catholic Church and democracy, which in Vatican I was condemned as anathema,
yeah,
and later on gets accepted, and particularly John Paul II, who experienced a lot of persecution under communism, becomes important in terms of helping to mobilize the Catholic Church into democratization movements, but also you have liberation theology, which John Paul II was not, but and other things like that, which have profound changes in terms of the Catholic Church and their association with the government and their willingness to critique the government. And then they have a lot of resources which can be mobilized on behalf of democracy when they choose to mobilize for it.
Yeah, absolutely, because they are a very large multinational organization that can bring, you know, international pressure to bear on a lot of
right.
places.
And also often have more ability now than small Protestant groups.
Yes.
Because if you kill a bishop, everyone in the world will know about it, and the Catholic Church has ability to mobilize people in the United States and France and Germany and various things like that to punish you. If you knock off a Pentecostal minister,
it's 16th page news.
Nobody knows.
Right.
And so it gives Catholic bishops more ability to speak in really repressive situations than members of Protestant groups that are not part of large multinational denominations.
Yeah. Now I want to come back to Protestants, and one of the questions I have for you: use the term conversionary Protestant in your article, and this
yes.
is just an aside here. I'd never really heard that term or used that term before.
Right.
Protestant missionaries, when you say that, everybody knows what a Protestant missionary is. They're the people in the suit in a poor area holding the Bible. Why did you choose the term conversionary Protestant?
Because I wanted to apply it to Europe and North America as well.
I see.
So, like the people who are spreading Presbyterianism, or Puritanism, or Lutheranism, or whatever after the Reformation, and then the people who are spreading Baptism and Quakerism and Methodism and things like that—they don't necessarily fit under the label missionary.
Mm-hmm.
Although I could expand the definition, it'd be a little bit. People don't tend to think, "Oh, these are missionaries; they're evangelists," because it's within their own culture. They are mobilizing these changes in Europe and North America. And the fact that they're trying to convert people makes other people change and go against their economic and political interests. So people end up doing the things that they would not do if they were just trying to preserve their economic and political interests, because they have religious interests also. And they don't want people to become that thing, whatever they don't like. And that's what causes them to change their behavior. So, like, if we look at the spread of printing, now, printing developed first in East Asia, in China, about 800 to 900 years before Europe. It spreads to Korea and Japan and Vietnam, Korea and China had movable font metal type before Europe. Japan had movable font metal type from the 1590s. It never led to newspapers. It never led to like a public sphere like Habermas talked about. It never led to universal literacy. It never led to cumulative science. It never led to all these things that are supposedly caused by printing in Europe. Now, the rest of Asia and North Africa and the Middle East knew about printing for hundreds and hundreds of years and were repeatedly exposed to it and didn't copy it. So you have Mongols who take over China, and the ones who become Mahayana Buddhists use printing. The ones who become Muslims don't. They use printing to print paper money, which people hate, so they stop, and to print amulets, which people like, so they continue. But nobody uses them for books. Then you get Jews who are escaping persecution in Spain, and they go to Turkey and to Central Asia, etc., and print, and nobody copies them, except for Eastern Christians, who do small numbers of texts. Catholic missionaries come, print small numbers of texts. Western trade companies come, print small numbers of texts. All the major languages of Asia, North Africa, and the Middle East had been printed in Europe by the 1600s. And people were exporting texts, mostly Bibles, but other things, in those languages through these trade companies to other countries. Catholic missionaries gave a working printing press and vernacular fonts to the Mughal emperor and the Persian emperor, and nobody used them. So it's, and like, South Asia and East Asia were economically comparable to Europe, at least into the 1700s. And they had very good metalworking technology. They had very good dyes. India was way ahead of Europe in terms of dyeing and block printing and other things like that. They had the technology to print. It was not something that was culturally valuable. The elite wanted to be able to control text, so they didn't do it. Then you get Protestant missionaries coming along, and they start to print tens of thousands of texts in the local language, and all of a sudden, oh my goodness, we better print too, because we don't want them to become Protestant.
We don't want to be left behind in the wake of these of what's going on here, right?
You see, so then they undermine, before they're resisting because they want to keep control of text, and these small numbers of printed texts from other people don't undermine their ability to control text, because it's a very small number, and they tended to be printed in elite languages or foreign languages, or languages of a minority. But when Protestants print for ordinary people in vernacular languages, it becomes a threat, and then they have to start to print.
Yeah, and that also leads to the diffusion of knowledge.
Exactly.
Which leads to empowerment. And so it's not just the printing press. And people have noticed that before, right? There's been arguments about, well, the printing press and technology, or printing press and democracy, or printing press and economic growth. Your article, your research really connects this at the grassroots level. It's not just the printing press per se, don't stop there, but it's actually how it's used, who's using it, and who are they giving it to.
Right. Because one, knowing how to do something doesn't mean you think it's valuable and do it.
Mm-hmm.
Two, having a technology doesn't mean you extend it to the extreme of what it could be used.
Right.
Having the printing press for 800 to 900 years before, well, not the printing press, but have printing, mostly wood block, but also movable font printing,
yeah,
in East Asia, hundreds and hundreds of years before Europe, did not have the same consequences until the 19th century, when Protestant missionaries reintroduce movable font metal type and create the fonts that dominate printing in Japan and Korea and China for the 19th century, introduce the techniques that then are used by the Japanese government, by other Japanese and by the Chinese, etc. And the early printers that control the major book publishing houses in China, for example, get their fonts from missionaries, or Christians, etc. So it's, you can see this huge effect in terms of the spread of printing, but mostly that just gets whitewashed out of history and people don't know about it. So like going back and figuring out who the first printers are and where they got their fonts and all this kind of stuff is an amazing amount of work.
Yeah, no, and you did it extremely well. I as we're discussing this too, and you're talking about the printing press, you kind of think of Gutenberg's printing press in my mind as we're talking about this. But the other thing that popped into my head was that religious groups, particularly those that are, as you say, conversionary Protestants, or ones that take the calling of the Great Commission very seriously to spread the faith far and wide, are not only expanding printing technology, but they get onto the bandwagon of a lot of other technologies too. We had an earlier discussion with a historian about the evangelist Amy Semple McPherson,
right,
who they got into radio, right, and stage show presentations. Yeah. And you know, later in the 1960s, a number of religious groups were at the forefront of mass mailings. They figure out, oh, we can use the post office to reach people. So for all those folks who are complaining about getting junk mail in their mailbox every day, you know, that kind of goes back to Christian groups in the 1960s who said, hey, this is another way, another tool that we have for the Great Commission. So it's, you can see how religious groups are at the forefront of these technological innovations of spreading information and of organizing people and empowering people in that regard.
Yeah. And then we don't see it over time. One, because like, for example, the government came in and regulated radio waves, and so took
yep.
away these radio stations from these religious groups.
Yeah.
And gave them to economic ones. But also over time,
it also created a space for them. This is one of the interesting things. It gave a space for them on Sunday mornings to really boring religious groups.
Right.
Because I remember growing up in the 60s and 70s, you know, Sunday morning, there would be the really, you know, dull person talking some liturgical thing, and like, wow, this is boring. But when they deregulated that, that's when you get televangelism and big hairdos and all that kind of stuff. So
well, there's pluses and minuses about
that. Yeah, I guess. I don't know. Big hair is kind of cool. Hey, I want to we're getting near the end of our discussion here, and so I just want to also note, and we'll point people back to your article that you've written here, as well as a few others that you've written with former guest on the show Timothy Shaw. Mm-hmm. And a few others that you've done statistical work on. You're not just a data aggregator. You actually did a whole mess of statistical work on it. And that doesn't translate very well in the audio format that we use here. But half your article is these rigorous tests of that. And it comes out, right?
Right. So when you do historical arguments, people always worry, like, well, maybe you're just picking positive stories or stories that fit your case. So I also show it statistically. And you can show that the historic prevalence of Protestant missionaries explains about half of the variation in democracy in Africa, Asia, Latin America, and Oceania, and that Catholic missions has no effect on democracy, positive or negative. And Protestant missionaries removes the effect of most of the things that people have been writing about for 30 to 40 years. So it's a massive, 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 massive effect. So you can make a model that's like a standard model that you'd find in a good journal. Then you add Protestant missionaries, all those variables go away, and Protestant missionaries stay. And then you remove all those other variables, and the amount of variation explained goes down almost nothing. It goes down 0.4%, which means all those other variables explained almost nothing.
Yeah.
So, like, these effects are huge. Now, I'm not claiming that there's not something I didn't measure. I tried, like, 50-something other variables to see if you could remove the Protestant mission effect, and it doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
There may be something else that makes that effect smaller. You can never prove that. But it's pretty rigorous in terms of the statistical analyses. And for those who know statistics, I also do instrumenting in 9 different ways.
Yeah.
And it's consistent. So
I should note that the American Political Science Review, again, the flagship journal of the American Political Science Association, is a very rigorous process of peer review.
And this was way more than anything I've ever heard of.
Yeah.
So, like, I have like 30 tables. There's like 12 tables I don't have because I had to show that missions was related to each one of my intervening mechanisms. They made me do 5 case studies. They said, like, hey, we want you to do India and China and whatever and show how this works in these countries. So I did those. I had to show change through time so that on average where Protestant missionaries went, there was less education before they went and more education after they went. Various things like that in order to get it in. And some of that I asked to be able to publish separately.
Yeah, no, the amount of data and analysis that you have is incredible. You have to go to a separate site to get all of the stuff because it won't fit into the journal article. But, you know, the other thing is not only that it was rigorously tested and peer-reviewed, but also the fact that you use these mixed methods, that there is a qualitative historical study that you tell in addition to the statistical study, which, I mean, bolsters each argument, right?
Exactly.
You can say, well, you know, in the historical stuff, you're just selecting acting on the dependent variable. But then, you know, people who criticize statistics say, you omitted variable bias and you're massaging the numbers. But, you know, both of those together, that's a pretty strong case, incredibly strong case, actually. Mm-hmm. I want to finish up here. I'm talking about Muslim societies. We haven't really talked about that. Now, there's been some in history. There was, especially in the first half of the 20th century, European imperialism in the Middle East. And you don't see the rise of democracy there as you do in other places. So I'm curious about that. But I'm also curious about what your thoughts are on the Arab Spring, which may or may not be the next wave of democratization. And you're, admittedly, your paper does not deal with that, so right. I'm letting you off the hook here. But I always like to let scholars speculate and take their arguments into new territories on the show.
Okay. Well, the Muslim world got colonized much later and much weaker than virtually any other part of the world. And also blocked missionaries. So you have less of these things going on. Missionaries in the Ottoman Empire were only allowed to work with Jews and Christians, and you see them moving way up in terms of their economic standing over time. And the Ottomans try to adjust because they don't want Muslims to go to the schools, but they prevent missionaries from working with missionaries from working with Muslims. It has a detrimental effect in terms of the spread of mass education, printing, volunteer organizations, etc. Until much later, except for in places like Egypt, which get colonized by the British and where missionaries are allowed, and places like Lebanon. So where you have large Christian populations, you get some of these things, which are passed on. And so then the early newspaper writers, the early creators of people like the Ba'ath Party, things like that, are disproportionately Christian because of this influence through Protestant missions. Or graduate from mission schools like the American University of Beirut and the American University of Cairo. And Roberts College, which is now the University of the Bosphorus, et cetera. So the argument works there in terms of, and also when you control for Muslims, there's a negative effect on democracy until you control for missions and then it goes away. So it could be plausible that this is, the Muslim effect is really because they block missionaries.
Mm-hmm. So your thoughts on the Arab Spring? I mean, where is this going?
Thoughts on the Arab Spring? Democratic transitions are messy. Right now, it's pretty messy. We have to wait and see. I mean, hopefully, work. Religious traditions change over time. The Catholic Church certainly has. There are some challenges to liberal democracy in Islam, such as some aspects of Sharia law as it's been traditionally interpreted. But religions change over time, and maybe it will work. I certainly hope so.
Yeah.
So far, it hasn't been good for religious minorities. There's been a lot of persecution that have gone on with some of these transitions.
Yeah, it sucks to be a Coptic Christian in Egypt right now.
Right, or a Christian in Iraq, or a Christian in anywhere in the Middle East, as well as non-Christians, Baha'is, Zoroastrians, who are called Parsis, Yazidis, Jews, etc. There's a persecution of all religious minorities, and also Muslim minorities, so Ahmadiyyas, etc.
Mm-hmm.
So it hasn't led to sort of a liberal democracy, but maybe that will develop over time. We'll see.
Yeah, we're wondering if some of these protest movements have the same kind of organizational effect. You know, they talk about the Twitter revolution. That's, I guess, the new printing press and to some extent, and how people have to develop organizational skills. And you're wondering if, you know, that is going to have the same kind of effect, but we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, I mean, and a lot of these things have become detached from religion over time.
Mm-hmm.
So now people learn these voluntary organization techniques from other voluntary organizations. They don't need to learn them from Protestants, et cetera. So it's become detached and from Protestantism in many ways.
Well, the world marches on historically, and so must we as well as we finish off our discussion here with Robert Woodbury. We definitely will be keeping in touch with you to find out what you're working on and making more of that massive data set that you've collected. So please do stay in touch. And Bob, I want to thank you for being on Research on Religion.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.